Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touchtone telephone. And as a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Mary, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, Living with Chronic Myelogenous Leukemia, or CML, Current Perspectives on Survivorship. And I know many of you have waited for this program for quite some time, and we have wonderful speakers, and I think you're going to find it most interesting. Today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, and it really is because of that collaboration that we have been able to reach so many of you on the call today. Now, we have on the call today over 853 participants, and you come from all over the United States, from all different regions and states in this United States, and we also have international participants from Argentina, Australia, Canada, China, India, Korea, South Africa, Syria, United Kingdom, and Venezuela. So you truly come from all over the world, and it's really a pleasure to have all of you join us today. You are clearly a group of information seekers. Now, today's program was made possible through an educational grant from Pfizer Oncology, and I really want to thank them for their support of this program. I would like to turn your attention for a moment to the materials that you received from Cancer Care. In those materials, there's an outline that our speakers have prepared, and there's information about all the different collaborating organizations. Now, there also is in the materials an evaluation form, and I would ask you to take a moment and complete that evaluation form. You know, when you think about it, who but each of you can best tell us what we should be doing? And, you know, we are planning lots of programs for the rest of this year, and I would encourage you to tell us what topics you'd like us to offer, because you really are best. You're the best people to tell us what we should be doing. You're living the experience, and you kind of have a really good sense of what should be done. So if you would take a moment to complete the evaluation forms and tell us what you want, we will very much try to implement your suggestions. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to start by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Jeff Kramer, and Jeff Kramer is a CML survivor, and he's going to give you a survivor perspective. And it's my pleasure to turn this program over to Jeff to really start the program off and set the context for the program today. Jeff?
Thank you, Dr. Messner. I was diagnosed back in September of 1998. At the time, I had no symptoms, but I had fairly severe allergies, so my GP decided to do some blood work. And at that point, the blood work came back and showed that I had a white count of 37,000. Totally surprising, obviously, and he said it looked like a form of leukemia, but he, you know, insisted that I obviously go to a hematologist. So I found a top hematologist at Columbia Presbyterian. He did preliminary tests and diagnosed it as early-stage CML. I had several siblings, so he had those siblings tested, and one of them, fortunately, was a match. Now, at the time, back at that time, there were only two treatment options, either interferon or bone marrow transplant. A transplant was considered the only cure for leukemia. I wound up going to the Fred Hutchinson Transplant Center in Seattle for the transplant. When they did some preliminary evaluations at Seattle, they discovered that my donor had some kind of a problem, and they couldn't determine what it was, so they canceled the transplant, and I went back to New Jersey and started a protocol of interferon. My wife was the main reason for saving my life due to her commitment to using the Internet for research, for researching the best doctors, transplant centers, online CML support groups, and many other support mechanisms. In addition to using my doctor at Columbia, she had determined there were other specialists we can consult with, both at Sloan Kettering and MD Anderson. So before I started interferon treatment, I met with a leading expert on interferon at MD Anderson. He advised me to do the proper protocol for interferon and communicated this to my doctor in New York, and they had ongoing communications to make sure that I was being treated the proper way. At the time of diagnosis, having been healthy all my life, managing the shock and fear of having CML was a major concern. With my wife's help, we found the support to help me cope with this fear in a number of ways. She had discovered, as I said before, online CML patient support groups, medical research sites about the latest leukemia treatment protocols and clinical trials. We also discovered the local New Jersey branch of the National Leukemia Society and its support programs, and, of course, the New Jersey chapter of Cancer Care and all the benefits it offered patients. Personally, my instincts were to reach out to people in any way I could for support. This effort led me to some close friends who were very involved in alternative healing and general spirituality principles. Now, when I say spirituality, I'm not talking about being religious, but about discovering general principles extracted from many religions that can help you cope with everyday life in a better way. As an example, there's a book called The Power of Now, written by a top scholar and researcher in this area, that tells you how to live in the moment and not worry about the future. And it emphasizes that the present really dictates what the future will be. I also worked with a healer, an alternative healer, who taught me about meditation and visual imagery. These are also tools that help bring your mind back to the present and stop worrying about the future, and it really does help reduce anxiety. As I mentioned earlier, the discovery of online CML support groups turned out to be a tremendous advantage. Not only did CML patients get to know each other and share experiences about treatment and coping with problems, the families got connected too. So connected, these groups became a great source of compassion from people who all shared the same point of view, and in fact, we became very good friends meeting each other at different times of the year, yet they were people from all over the United States. The New Jersey Leukemia Society provided countless learning programs about recent medical discoveries in the leukemia area and put me in a program called First Connection, where I counseled newly diagnosed CML patients, giving them hope when facing the same fears and anxieties that I did for the first time. At the Cancer Care headquarters in New Jersey, I discovered I could get free individual counseling with a trained professional. This became so important to me because there are so many times when you need a way to express your ongoing concerns to someone outside your family who can be much more objective and instructive in helping you cope. They also offer local support groups and financial assistance, as well as educational programs like this phone conference. The online medical websites were a big source of hope because we discovered continual research and clinical testing that resulted in the development of Gleevec, the first targeted cancer drug of its kind. In fact, all of us participating in the online CML support groups played a big part in fast-tracking Gleevec through the FDA approval process. As a result, Gleevec quickly became an important alternative to bone marrow transplants for many CML patients and has helped many to deal with CML as a chronic disease rather than a purely terminal one. Our online petition was instrumental in the fast-tracking process. So I hope this information has been of some value in guiding many of you as to the ways to approach the process of living with this condition. Thanks a lot.
Well, thank you very much, Jeff. That was really quite remarkable, wonderful, really almost like a keynote address for our program today, really setting the stage for the program and really sharing with everyone on the call really what has helped you to really cope with, you know, with CML and how well you're doing. So thank you so much. And I know that people will have questions for you and comments during the Q&A. Our next speaker is Dr. Michael Morrow. Dr. Morrow is Associate Professor, Center for Hematologic Malignancies, Knight Cancer Institute at Oregon Health and Science University. And Dr. Morrow is going to present an overview of CML and survivorship, current standard of care, new treatment approaches and clinical trials, and the benefits of communicating with your healthcare team. Dr. Morrow?
Thank you, Carolyn, and welcome to everyone. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, no matter where you are, and it's a pleasure to be joining you to speak about CML, a topic that's quite close to my heart. I also want to echo the comments Carolyn said. That was a wonderful way to start off things. I'm inspired by hearing patients who have navigated through the early discoveries in CML and made decisions about different therapy options and have really navigated well and set an example for others. Well, CML has clearly evolved dramatically over the past 10 years. In fact, this spring we celebrated the 10-year anniversary of the FDA approval of amantadine or Gleevec for chronic phase CML. That was a landmark event, the fastest FDA approval at that time for a drug, and really set the stage for 10 more years of progress. CML is a unique disease. We know so much about the underpinnings of it, the why it happens, the fact that it's really the first human cancer linked to a sole genetic abnormality, the Philadelphia chromosome, first described in 1960. So essentially we have a threatening disease but with a very discrete underpinning or cause. And back more than a decade ago, it really wasn't perhaps conceivable that an oral once a day treatment, oral once or twice a day treatment, would be a comprehensive, effective, and long-term effective treatment for CML. And that's where we are in 2011. In 2001, imantinib was FDA approved, and we proved that it was a much better treatment option for patients compared to interferon, much like the story we just heard. We know it gained approval for first use in chronic phase CML. It changed the way we treat the disease. Bone marrow transplant became a treatment that was reserved for select cases, and was we were able to diminish the number of cases in whom stem cell transplant was necessary. Quite quickly, we discovered that resistance or mechanisms of resistance existed where patients might not respond to Gleevec, or they might respond and then lose response. And there was a population in need, and two drugs, nilotinib and dasatinib, were FDA approved in 2006 and 2007 for use in patients who hadn't responded to or who lost response or who couldn't tolerate imantinib. And that was another huge advance. In 2010, those same drugs, after several years of careful study, were then FDA approved for use in the frontline setting. So our current landscape in 2011 is quite interesting. We actually have three different medications, Gleevec, Sprycel, and Tasigna, or imantinib, dasatinib, and nilotinib, all prescribable for a patient who's just been diagnosed with CML. They're all highly effective therapies. They're all well tolerated. They're all oral once or twice a day medications. And change from 10 years ago when none of these compounds existed. Our current standard in CML is to use one of those three agents at diagnosis. And that's a bit of a conundrum, because how do we choose? And that's a careful question under scrutiny by CML physicians and oncologists in general, and there's a focus of research. We've clearly seen trials recently published that which show a bit of an advantage for the use of nilotinib, and to a similar degree, perhaps not as strong, but similar data with dasatinib, showing an advantage with regards to response and protection against CML worsening or progressing, and excellent tolerability, really no significant penalty for using more therapy rather than the standard sort of more established therapy of Gleevec or imantinib. Now, people have started to adapt this into their thinking, and slowly we're seeing a shift in more and more patients who are diagnosed being treated. There isn't treated with dasatinib and nilotinib. There isn't necessarily a need to switch patients en masse from Gleevec off Gleevec onto nilotinib and dasatinib if they're responding. So let me be clear about that if someone is tolerating Gleevec well and has a good remission, and they've been that way for several years, they're actually probably quite safe, probably have very little risk of CML worsening or relapsing or progressing, and they may be served over the long term quite well. It would be good if we could, and we're working hard on this in the research side of things, to develop tools to help us better understand which patients might be suitable for which therapy, and the theme of personalized medicine certainly has evolved in CML and may bear fruit in the coming years, and we may be able to develop algorithms. Right now, we really don't have a clear screening test, so all the drugs are available, and I encourage everyone who's either treating, advising, caring for, or just a loved one of a patient with CML is to ask questions and to query about all these options if it's a new diagnosis, to be quite cognizant of the fact that if things aren't going well, we have a lower threshold if someone has side effects, if someone has inadequate response, if someone's, heaven forbid, lost response. There are clearly not one but two alternative options. And let me in addition mention perhaps where the future really may be going in as well, is that we continue to develop new generations of what are called kinase inhibitors or small molecule drugs that work in CML. And there's a third generation drug which is going through careful testing now in what's called phase two, where the dose is set and the response and the safety is being further evaluated, a drug called ponatinib. And this drug has shown very promising results in phase one testing for chronic phase CML. It's able to work when other drugs don't in a general sense, and it's very specifically able to work in a select setting when there's a certain mutation or change in the target of the drug, the BCR-ABL kinase, called a 315 mutation, where the drug is even more effective than the general, that group sort of rises above and is even better treated than the general population of patients in whom the drug's been studied. Although I should say that the rates in the general group of chronic phase CML, the data is very encouraging. In fact, it's probably a bit better than nilotinib and dasatinib looked when we first used them for patients who had failed imatinib. So the future is quite bright. We might see different algorithms develop in the latter part of this decade. As we get closer to 2015, we might be using even newer drugs earlier in CML. We might set our bar very high. And my colleague, Dr. Jabbour, who we're going to hear from later, has done some very important research looking at how quickly does someone need to respond to treatment and how high should we set the bar. The good news is we can set our expectations very high and look for most patients to get early bone marrow or cytogenetic remission. So the research continues. The treatment landscape is quite broad. It's a bit complicated, honestly. So it's important for physicians, patients, and care providers of all of us to be quite deliberate in our thinking and critical in our thinking and to encourage everyone to ask the right questions, for us to monitor patients quite closely with regular testing. It's typical for a patient to have early testing at 3 and 6 months, looking for blood and bone marrow remission. Those are early time points, which are quite predictive. It's common for a patient to have a bone marrow study at diagnosis and then a follow-up bone marrow shortly thereafter, again at 3 to 6 months, which are pretty crucial times to tell us how therapy is working. Most patients are served over the long term with molecular testing or PCR-based testing, as bone marrow remissions are quite readily occurring, and our more important questions are coming with the long-term follow-up of patients over now decades. I'm so pleased to say that a decade later, after Gleevec was approved, the majority of patients treated on that trial are still in response and still on treatment, and I think the future is looking even brighter with regards to newer drugs, more powerful drugs, and even third-generation drugs which are on the horizon. So thank you for your attention. I apologize. I'm unable to stay for the questions and answers, and I'll turn things over to my colleagues.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Morrow, for really this very insightful and very informative presentation, and really in terms of the landscape of CML, and we so appreciate you being on the call, so thank you so much, and safe travels. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Elias Jabbour, and Dr. Jabbour is Assistant Professor, Department of Leukemia, Division of Cancer Medicine, the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. It's a pleasure to have Dr. Jabbour on the call today. He's spoken on a number of our programs in the past, and he's going to cover managing post-treatment side effects and late effects, the importance of treatment summaries, follow-up with your oncologist and primary care doctor, and quality of life concerns. It's my pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Jabbour.
Thank you, Carolyn. Hello, everybody. It's really a pleasure being here. I mentioned it, Carolyn, before starting. You have my commitment for this course to have always a dialogue between you and us in order to optimize the outcome of this disease. We're lucky to live in an era where we're making the cure for cancer. CML, as Jeff mentioned at the beginning, when he was diagnosed, he was told survival 67 years. Now, we're living normally. We're having a normal lifespan. And that is because of the research that was done, the discoveries of new drugs, started with imatinib, as Dr. Morrow mentioned, followed by the second-generation tyrosine kinase inhibitors and other drugs available and coming in a short horizon. Therefore, today we're living normally, taking medication that can control our disease. No, there's no medication whatsoever that doesn't have side effect and doesn't have some cumbersome side of it. So it's really important to know that with this kind of therapy, we may face side effects, but most of them are really manageable and highly manageable. We have the luxury to have three drugs. A couple of years ago, when imatinib was the only drug available, we were okay. We were able to deal with side effect and manage it appropriately. Today, with other options available, we see in our patients coming to see us more ease to switch to other drugs. I want to highlight one thing very, very important. What does matter is your response. If you're responding to therapy, every effort should be made to control side effect. Unless really you've tried everything and it's not working, then switch to other drugs. What does matter is your response. We've seen patients switching from one drug to another because of side effect. Another day, they lose their response. So it's really important to speak to your physician, to your mid-levels, and try to come up with a treatment plan for the side effect, because most of them, as I mentioned, are highly manageable. And more important than that, these are predictable. So when you go see your doctor and you sit with him, side effects are predictable. We can anticipate them in most of the cases. And we've learned from the studies done from the IRIS trial and other trials that most of side effects do take place the first year or 2 years. And later on, we have less side effects. So we can anticipate the most common side effects, from myelosuppression to bone ache to fluid retention. All these, they do take place early on, and later on, we have less side effects. So really, what's important is to be aware, to be alerted about the side effect, and if you face any one of them, call your doctor, call your mid-level, and try to come up with a treatment plan that can control the side effect and then lead to a better outcome. And why I'm saying that? I'm saying that because when we have resistance and we fail, most of the cases we fail because we don't take our medication. And to be honest, it's a long-term treatment. It's not only for 1 day, a month, or 3 months. It's for life. And if I have side effect, even a grade one, and I'm a physician and I take the medication, antibiotics sometimes, and I don't accept it. So even if I have a side effect grade one, chronically it's not acceptable. And we have medications that can help you palliate this side effect. So we really need to make every effort, physician, patient, everybody, to come up with a solution for this side effect in order to eradicate this side effect, and by doing so, we can improve adherence. Because your long-term outcome, your cure, does depend on you taking your medication. And it's really hard and risky to drop medication because the end point, you lose your response. Publications from United States of America, from London, from Europe, from Asia, everybody, they did highlight that the importance of response relies on adherence. Patients who are not well adherent will not achieve an optimal response, such as complete cytogenic response or a major molecular response. And yet, even if you do achieve this response, if you skip your medication, then you will lose your response. Therefore, the best way to optimize long-term outcome or survival or deep responses is by being adherent. Being adherent means taking the drug every day, means no side effect. So it's really important to talk to your doctor and try to optimize supportive care in order to have an early response that will translate into improvement of long-term outcome. So again, I reiterate on that. It's really important. Side effects are highly predictable. They do take place early on. Most of them are grade 1 and 2 and are really manageable. Now, how about late effect? You know, Dr. Morrow mentioned we're celebrating the 10-year anniversary of imatinib, which is a breakthrough in the treatment of CML. And we're lucky to be in an era where we're going to see the cure of CML with therapy or without therapy, hopefully in the future. But for people who were conservative at the beginning or skeptical, and you know, or instances they observe for side effects, we have not seen late side effect taking place on imatinib therapy or nilotinib or dasatinib. So side effects are merely early on, and once you reach a steady state where you don't have, you have a good response and taking your drug, we have not seen a late side effect. Mainly, there was no increase in the incidence of infections, whatever drug you're taking. Cancers, solid cancers, we have not seen an increase, significant increase. There, we did not see cardiotoxicity. There were 3 years ago some report, imatinib may be cardiotoxic. That is clarified. Nilotinib and dasatinib, all drugs, they have no bad effect on the heart. And therefore, we today, we're confident to say that long-term outcome of CML with therapy with tyrosine kinase inhibitors is really safe and there is nothing to worry about. But that said, that again, doesn't mean we don't take the drug. Keep in mind that you have to take a drug. And the follow-up with your doctors, I know with the long-term outcome, with being in remission and seeing less often our doctors, we may try to forget. Keep in mind, you are accountable for what's going to happen to you. So there is milestones that are well-defined that can tell you exactly where you're standing. And this is what we call important treatment summaries, where I'm on treatment, I'm reaching this milestone, where I am sending response-wise side effect profile. So always keep that in mind and discuss it with your doctor. We have several options today available, so if you fail, we can switch to other drug, but keep in mind it's only for failure. What's important in CML therapy is to reach certain milestone at every time, especially early responses. We're publishing and we're doing research to highlight that having achieved a complete response at certain time early on is really critical for the future for the patient, and that is being validated by other group. So it's really important to keep in mind where we're standing, at what time we start, at 6 months, 12 months, 18 months, 24 months, and later on, when to optimize therapy, when to switch therapy, what to do, when to do monitoring. One more thing, once you reach a complete response, the outcome is steady. It means predictable, not only for side effects, for responses. Patients who did achieve a complete response, and they are beyond 2 years, usually it's very predictable. The outcome is highly predictable. We've rarely seen patients losing their response, provided they're taking their medication. And as I said, side effect profile is very, very predictable. So therefore, what's important is to always have a good communication with your doctors, with your mid-levels, with the healthcare provider about diagnosis, about the tools for monitoring, what to do, when to do a bone marrow, when to do blood test. I know today we have PCR in the countries. We have karyotype done, so it's important to have a karyotype done early on to document the response, and later on we'll be less aggressive by monitoring and doing mainly a blood test. Again, be aware of the milestones to be achieved, 3 months, 6 months, 12 months, 18 months, and focusing on early responders, they do great. Third, optimize side effect profile. Talk to your doctor, talk to your healthcare provider if you have shortness of breath, for example, pleural effusion, you have diarrhea, you have skin rash, you have diabetes problem. All these, please bring them to the attention of your healthcare provider and talk about it, because we can handle them, and by handling them, we can have a better outcome. Again, there was no concern about long-term side effect. Mainly, there was no increase of the incidence of cancer. There was no thrombotic events, clots or DVTs or pulmonary emboli or other things. And mainly, there was no increase in the incidence of infection. So the immune system is recovered. Once you have somebody responding, there was no increase in the setting of infections. Quality of life, I think today the quality of life is great. With several options, a lot of these drugs are easy to be taken. There's no problem. And we've seen that the quality of life of patients do improve with the kind of response. Somebody who's responding nicely, we did a survey on 123 patients, and we showed that the response does come with some form of satisfaction and freedom for the long-term outcome. So we are in a great shape today. A lot of progress have been made from a disease where survival used to be 6 to 7 years to a normal lifespan. And we have very effective therapy up front. As Dr. Morrow stated, we have three options today, nilotinib, imatinib, and dasatinib. For patients who fail therapy at different milestones, we have options as well, nilotinib and dasatinib. And today we have other drugs available. So just please communicate with your healthcare provider. Talk to us, and we'll be happy to provide you with any information you need. I want to reiterate about one thing. Adherence is critical. Today, we do not stop therapy. Please take your medication as prescribed by your doctor. Do not skip medication. And whenever you face problem, call us, because we can handle it. And therefore, the idea is to optimize adherence and optimize long-term outcome. So CML, yes, indeed, it's curable. And in our lifetime, it's curable, and hopefully we can generalize this medicine to other cancer as well. Thank you very much, and I'll be happy to take any question.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Jabbour, for just a wonderfully informative and just an excellent presentation, and particularly in terms of really focusing on the importance of adherence so people understand about that. And I'm sure there'll be questions for you about that during the Q&A, and the fact that there's just so much hope in the treatment of CML. This is really terrific. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Rick Dickens, and Rick is an oncology social worker. He's our Blood Cancers Program Coordinator, Mind, Body, Spirit Project Coordinator at Cancer Care. And Rick is going to talk about the importance of a support network and also the free psychosocial support services accessible from Cancer Care. Rick?
Thank you, Carolyn. I appreciate the educational and expert advice of Drs. Morrow and Jabor, and especially the comprehensive personal story by Jeff. Thank you very much. And telling you all about cancer care services, I'm going to reinforce the information that many of the previous speakers have already introduced. Building relationships with all members of your healthcare team is important, especially with a chronic cancer like CML. This team usually includes a doctor, nurse, social worker, and other professionals. So it's helpful to think of this as a partnership or collaboration. It's also important to build a personal support network of family and friends from your neighborhood and community center or house of worship. For many patients, it is hard to say, I need help. But for people who care about you, helping is one thing they can give. That is why, by reaching out to as many as possible, you help the caregivers to spread the help and thereby help themselves. Accepting changes are normal during treatment, which contributes toward nurturing your body and spirit. But stressors can elicit feelings of sadness and frustration. When it is happening to the patient, it can make family and friends feel helpless and scared as well. And this is when it is helpful to seek help of a social worker or other professionals from organizations such as Cancer Care. Cancer Care has oncology social workers who inform people of resources and strategies for finding help, which can include helping you use new technologies to keep your network informed, or mind-body-spirit techniques to calm the mind and relax the body during stress. Along with education and resources, Cancer Care provides some financial assistance, counseling, regional face-to-face groups, and national telephone and online groups for patients and loved ones, which Jeff explained so well through his own experience. Groups provide role models, emotional support, coping strategies, and validation you're not alone. Social supports, getting to know your healthcare team, and support groups go a long way in helping to confront the difficult challenges of cancer. And daunting as they are, with help, they are never impossible. You can call Cancer Care at 1-800-813-HOPE and speak to a social worker to explore how we can help. And I wish you all the best and look forward to your questions.
Well, thank you very much, Rick, for just a very excellent and just a very compassionate presentation and letting everyone know about all the services that they can access from Cancer Care, as well as really echoing a lot of the comments from our previous speakers and supporting them. Thank you so much. And now we do have time for questions. We actually have lots of time for questions, and I'm going to ask Mary to explain to you how to queue up and pose a question for our speakers. And I'm going to ask Mary to bring on Jeff Kramer, Dr. Jabor, and Rick Dickens. All of our lines are open, so we're all ready and primed to take everyone's questions. Okay, Mary?
Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, may press the pound key. Our first question comes from Jerry T.
My question is, I have a tremendous problem. I love to dance, and I have perspire very heavily. Is the Gleevec causing this perspiration, excessive perspiration, when there's type of, you know, in dancing and things like that?
That's an excellent question. Thank you for asking that question. I'm going to ask Dr. Jabor if you would address Jerry's question.
Well, we've seen really this kind of side effect. However, what I would advise you to do is get the endocrine consult, make sure that there are no other endocrine problems before attributing to Gleevec.
And clearly, for Jerry, I think this activity is very important. So that's an excellent point. Our next question.
Our next question comes from Carl M.
Hi there. I would like some feedback on generally the frequency for necessity of bone marrow biopsies. There seems to be a lot of different ideas from different medical facilities and caregivers. What's the frequency, the necessity? Should it be done with a local, with an oral pain med? Should you be put into twilight sleep with pain med? What are your feelings on that, please?
Dr. Shapiro?
Okay, great question. We do bone marrow at the beginning. That is a must. At diagnosis, you need to get a bone marrow aspiration biopsy done. then you need to confirm your complete response by a bone marrow aspiration and biopsy. The recommendations are clear on that, that you have to do it at the beginning, at every 6 months, till you get a complete response. Now, once you get the complete response, do we need it further or not? Here is where the debate is. We need it only in one setting, sometimes in patients responding, where the Philadelphia chromosome is completely gone. We've seen in 10% of the cases other abnormalities that are not relevant in the majority of the situation. So if we see these abnormalities, we will repeat the bone marrow just to make sure it's transient and it's gone. Otherwise, we don't do it. We can do it once every other year or once every 3 years, and we can rely on a blood test like PCR and FISH for the monitoring. Now, if we do blood test and we see that there's something abnormal, then we will have to repeat the bone marrow to check if there's any loss of response or something going on. We do bone marrow as well when you see the count coming down, not early on, later on. Somebody who has responded and the count starts dropping, we would like to get the bone marrow done to see if there is really loss of response, which is quite unusual. Now, how to do the bone marrow pain-wise? I think the best way is to do bone marrow, ask somebody who has experience, who does a lot of bone marrows, because technicality is really important. In my center, there's a dedicated team. They do bone marrows, so they do 25 bone marrows a day. They are really dedicated, and they do the best bone marrows ever. Now, we can do it with we give some medication like Ativan before, so the patient will feel relaxed. We put local anesthesia. We can put Amla cream, and then we do local anesthesia. In rare cases, we need to do like conscious sedation in OR, but I can say maybe 5% of the cases that will require conscious sedation. Most of the patient in people with good experience, pain medication starting and some local anesthesia is enough.
So that's really very important, because I know that's a procedure that many people have very strong feelings about, and I think what you're saying is that if done properly and with proper pain management, it is not as painful as it could be much more painful if it isn't appropriate pain medicine.
Correct.
Given. And could you repeat again what is the state of the art in terms of bone marrow aspiration so everyone can hear this and really take this away, because it's really important. I know many people on this call are having bone marrow aspirations.
Sure.
And it's interesting to hear a lot about.
The recommendations are to get the bone marrow at diagnosis, and then every 6 months till you reach the milestone of complete response. So at the beginning, every 6 months till you reach CCYR or complete response. After that, if you don't have any abnormalities, you can skip it and do bone marrow once every other year and less often thereafter. We don't do it anymore. And if you have abnormality, then you have to repeat your bone marrow in 6 months to make sure that it's transient and it doesn't cause any harm.
Okay, thank you. Our next question?
Our next question comes from Sharon W.
Hi, thank you for taking my question. Basically, it's two. I've been on Gleevec since December 2006, and I was diagnosed at a chronic stage, but I've had a really good response, so I really don't want to come off of it. But I do have issues with being very tired. And is this normal? Is there anything I can do to help support this? Is exercising more? Like, what is there anything I can do to alleviate that? And the other question I have is, we keep saying adherence is very important. Is it critical to be taking these meds? Like, I take it once a day. So is it critical I take it the same exact time every day? Is there an hour leeway? When you say adherence, how close do you mean to that?
Okay.
Great questions.
Okay, I want to start with the second question because it's easier. Adherence means every day. No, it's more or less same time, but if you're busy and you take your drug at the morning, 9 o'clock, and the next day you take it at 11, it's not a big deal. As long as it's either morning or evening, 1 hour more or less, it doesn't affect anything so far. Just do not skip medication and do not avoid medication, and then check for drug interactions as well. Sometimes we take another drug, antibiotic course for a week or so. That may have interaction, and that may limit the drug availability in the blood. So check with your doctor when you are prescribing another medication. Talk about fatigue. Yes, we've seen with imatinib fatigue as a side effect. 20% of the cases, mainly grade 1 and 2. The question is, how is it affecting your life? Is it affecting your life? Then obviously we have to consider other strategies, mainly other drugs. If it's not, then we can handle it. The one thing is important is always, as I said at the beginning, it could be a thyroid dysfunction, could be an endocrine problem, hormonal problems, that you need to discuss it with your doctor and see if there's any problem with that. If you don't have endocrine problems, it's only CML imatinib-related and it's affecting your life, I think you're entitled to switch to other drugs.
And I
Carolyn, this is Rick.
Yes.
Could I jump in on that question?
Oh, please do. Yes, Rick, yes.
Okay. And Sharon, I hear this a lot as a social worker about fatigue, and fatigue definitely, as Dr. Jabbour said, wants to first be addressed with your healthcare team. But there are the psychological implications of dealing with a chronic illness. And more studies that are being done with people who do exercise. Now, clearly, if you're dealing with an illness like cancer, the exercise might be much lighter, but the exercise itself can actually reinvigorate and get the body moving in a lot of ways. I say this from my own understanding in mind, body, spirit, is that when we're under stress, we don't always breathe properly. And exercise does help us breathe and helps us get the 20% of every breath that is the oxygen back into our hemoglobin and our B cells and flood through our body and really rejuvenate it to some degree. So I really think that exercise can be helpful sometimes within the capacity that you actually can address it. You don't want to tire yourself out. But even within that, also, there are simpler exercise techniques. Many people I work with do engage in yoga, being sensitive to what they can do within that. I teach on meditation, imagery, and a lot of those exercises. Jeff referred to some integrative medicines earlier. And they could be very helpful for people to address some of these physical manifestations that I think do have sometimes some psychological implications also of just being tired from the stress that you're under.
That's an excellent point. And Jeff, do you want to comment as well about the role of exercise in coping?
Yeah, I would agree that light exercise, of course, if you're under a lot of fatigue, you have to, do things in a very gentle way. And also, I even think that the idea of meditation is a great thing. It's tough for most people to do if they've never done it. It's something you have to train yourself to do. But meditation can even be done in a matter of several minutes. People are under the impression that when you do meditation, you have to work up to doing it as long as a half an hour. But that's not necessary. Just a few minutes of trying to calm yourself down mentally will actually relax your entire body, and it actually reinvigorates you.
Excellent. And Dr. Jabbour, this question about fatigue actually reminds me also of Jerry's question. I'm just wondering if you could comment on, we have done a number of programs around cancer and other health issues or concerns. And so can you speak to a little bit to the audience about if they do have a symptom that is particularly pressing for them, how they might go about working with both their oncologist and perhaps primary care doctor in getting that evaluated? Can you comment on that just in general? Because I think both Jerry and I think our current caller have similar, there's some similar issues here in terms of their.
Yes, so usually in matter of follow-up, patients with CML are followed by the local doctor and by primary physicians. So whenever you face side effects, you go see your doctor. You're entitled to have any problem, medical problem like anybody else, and that may not be only CML. So first go see your doctor, your primary doctor, get a general assessment. Sometimes it could be diarrhea, for example, from food poisoning or some infection. So treat it as is, and then let your doctor communicate with oncologist, or if you're at ease, you can communicate with oncologist as well, and try to have a conversation between doctors and yourself to really make the diagnosis of what's going on, what the best, what the most accurate diagnosis, and what the best tool to handle it, whether it's a re-education, it's physical therapy, it's medication, it's a diet issue. So it will be like a more consensus between you, your primary doctor, and the oncologist in how to handle it, and what are the expectations, and what are the factors that should be taken into consideration. For example, if you have side effect and it's chronic and you're losing your response, that is not acceptable. That means it's a warning sign. We have to switch therapy. We have to change all our strategies. So, again, reiterate the conversation between you, your primary doctor, and the oncologist, and rule out other reasons for side effect.
Excellent.
And, Carolyn, this is Rick again. I wonder if I could also add on that for a moment?
Yes, please.
And it was a great question, Jerry. Thank you very much. And again, I totally defer to Dr. Jabbour, and it needs to be addressed that way. I speak on many survivorship conferences and such, and humor is such an important part also of getting well. Again, brings us back to breath. And sometimes I will say to people who have the good fortune to have very treatable illnesses, cancers, that watch out, you might get what you wish for, you might survive your cancer and live long enough to suffer the infirmities of older age. And a lot of times that could just bring a little bit of laughter. I worked with a younger man once who had some concerns. He had a blood cancer about a pain in his hip, and he went to his doctor, and the doctor did a bone aspirin and did say to him, I'm sorry to say that it's not the NHL, but it sounds like it's arthritis. And the young man said, thank you, doctor. I hoped I should live long enough to hear the words that I have arthritis. As Dr. Jabbour said, you want to address this with your family physicians, but as we do get older, there are a myriad of issues, and the further you get from the impact of hearing the words you have cancer, it is easier to recognize that you also have the possibility of, in the aging process, being exposed to other issues that can be addressed, but perhaps by other doctors.
That is the whole issue, actually, and in terms of survivorship issues. And I wonder if Dr. Jabbour would comment on just that whole interplay between being followed by your oncologist and then also working also with a primary care doctor. I know there's a lot of discussion about in the CML world and the oncology field in general. Could you comment on that, Dr. Jabbour?
You know, before I comment, I want to add one thing very important, and I'm pleased that I heard it. You know, CML patients were, in the past, in 2000 and before, we were told survival is 6 to 7 years, and now we have a normal lifespan, and so we face the aging process, we face everything. And something very important, and I faced it last week in my clinic, you know, when a patient came to see us with leukemia, and we used to tell them, well, pregnancy is prohibited, contraception, and I had a patient who was 30 years old, and when she came to see me, she started seeing another doctor, and I saw her. She was 30 years old or 29 years old, and she was scared to death. She had leukemia, and I told her, no pregnancy. By all means, I won't get pregnant. And now she's coming to see me after 10 years. She's 40, and she wants to have a baby because her leukemia is part of the past. So I did not advise her to get pregnant, but I'm trying to say is with time where the leukemia is not an issue anymore, we start facing the aging problem and other issues that, again, that we should not, like, we should be aware that we can have these problems in life and that may not have nothing to do with leukemia. Again, that's what I reiterate, like, my comment is to always have an open communication between your primary doctor, the oncologist, and yourself, because we do not treat a disease. We treat a patient, a human being, who can face anything in life, and it's really important to have this open communication and anticipate, and whenever you have something, talk about it and be open, because earlier we intervene, better is the outcome.
That's excellent. That's really so very important. And then I do want to bring up the issue of adherence, because that is a big issue. It's actually, I have one of the online participants has asked that question as well. And I think we had a question about this as well, but how do you remember to take your pills on schedule? And it's so difficult for people, particularly as time goes out. And I wonder I'm going to start with Dr. Jabbour, if you have any particular tips that you'd like to highlight for people in terms of, you know, they're also taking their pills, also any potential for drug interaction in terms of working with their pharmacist, any types of recommendations that you would make so people
sure.
really keep track of all that.
Sure. First of all, drug interactions. So we all have internet today and we're all connected. And whenever you have a new drug, like you have a flu, you have a prescription, tell your doctor, tell your pharmacist, tell your healthcare provider, I have CML, I'm taking imatinib, I'm taking nilotinib, I'm taking dasatinib, will that interfere? Let them figure it out. And if not, yourself be responsible. And go online and Google it. There are drug interactions, and you can get a list of medication, and you can yourself be aware. No, again, I will advise you to talk to your doctor, but be aware that the drugs can have interaction, and some of them may not be as simple as you think. One. Second, regarding adherence and the way to take the drug, once a day may be different than twice a day. For example, twice a day, I'll tell my patients 10 by 10. You know, for example, nilotinib, you have to take it away from food. And if you have your breakfast at 7 o'clock in the morning and your dinner at 7, 8 o'clock in the evening, midday, 10 o'clock, usually people are at work or doing something, so not eating. And if they have dinner at 7, 8 o'clock, 10 o'clock, or 11, it's a bedtime. So I will say 10 by 10, apparently it's easy to memorize, and it's easy to follow, and then you can get your medication given. Now, lastly, for those who take once a day drug like imatinib or dasatinib, again, pick whatever you want. I prefer myself evening time before bedtime, unless you work at the evening or you have shift at evening time. Otherwise, I will take it in the evening before bedtime. And the easiest way, you go to sleep, no nausea or whatever is going to happen. You're sleeping, and you won't forget it. Like sometimes in the morning, you have to rush to go to work or something. So if once a day, I will advise you to take it evening bedtime. If twice a day, I will go by 10 by 10.
It's a really excellent, really recommendation, because I know this is quite daunting. Anyone else want to add anything to that? The concept of just remembering to do this. It's always hard to remember something every day. I think people find it often difficult. Rick or Jeff?
Well, in my case, because I was on interferon for the entire duration of my treatment, I wasn't. You know, I was doing it by injection, so you had to be very fastidious about when you took the injections. Mm-hmm. But it's a totally different thing when you're taking pills.
You know,
well, and this is. Go ahead, Jeff. I'm sorry.
You know, I want to add one thing to Jeff. You know, he had interferon and he moved to imatinib. And today, we're lucky to have oral agents. But for those who tell me side effects are really cumbersome, I mean, we're lucky we're taking imatinib, not interferon, because with interferon, side effects were really different and different scale. So by far, it's better the outcome is today, and side effect is really manageable.
Definitely.
And also, there are newer products out there, and forgive me if Dr. Jabbour had mentioned this before, but it is a lot of containers for people who are taking multiple medications, and some of them have little timers sometimes that do go off throughout the day that remind them to take those. Very prevalent over the years in the AIDS community and a number of other health concerns that really are on chronic need to take medications at certain times. So there are things that you could purchase to help remind you throughout the day.
And the other thing is, if you're planning on a vacation or planning a trip somewhere, or you're actually just going away for a weekend, you want to be sure that you have, your prescription on hand. And I wonder if Dr. Jabbour could just comment on that kind of preparedness all the time, to kind of have some sense that you want to have. You don't want to wait till the very last pill to decide you need to get a refill.
Correct. Correct. We always advise our patients, like, anticipate. Do not leave yourself to the last minute, because with the insurance plan, sometimes they won't get you a refill before. In my patients, I will give them prescription for more than they need. Although I talk to them, do not take it more. It doesn't mean if I write you 100 pills per month, you have to take the 100 pills, but at least to give you a margin of 10 days or a week if you're left without medication. But please anticipate and put your order or call your doctor and place prescription enough before time so you won't miss your medication. And you're going vacation in Hawaii, order your medication before you leave so you can get them and take them with you, and you don't have to miss your medication, because really missing medication time after time will put you at high risk of losing your response.
Excellent. Well, I want to thank all of the speakers today. You've been just a remarkable team, I must say. I want to thank you. I want to thank all of you who also have queued up and asked such great questions, both asking the questions on the phone and sending us questions and comments online. And I just think it's just an extraordinary program. I want to remind you that this is a one-hour program. So that means that when we plan this program, it's 1 hour. And although the program will end soon, the services that you can access from Cancer Care, those are endless, and those continue long after this program ends. And so I want to remind all of you that we do have a staff of 50 master's-level trained oncology social workers here, and we're here to provide a host of services. And we offer practical and financial assistance. We offer someone to talk to about your questions and concerns. We also offer support groups, both on the telephone and online. We also have lots of these type of workshops available coming up. We've actually done a workshop on adherence, remember to take your pills on schedule, so you might want to look at the previously done programs as well as programs we are offering going forward, because those might be of interest to you as well. We also offer materials and booklets. So there's a lot of things. We have a very active and robust website. And, of course, our staff are always available on our 800 number, 1-800-813-HOPE. So most importantly, as we conclude our program today, I would not want anyone to feel that you're alone. I want you to now feel that you're part of a community of support and that we are here for you and that you can call us anytime, and we're here to help you. I want to thank you all for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may disconnect and have a wonderful day.